for having me, Robert. I so enjoy the rare chances I get to come to L.A. and particularly to walk through UCLA's fine campus is a joy, and happy to share a panel with Bob Scheer. That's always a pleasure as well. I have to say I'm slightly, the one thing that does worry me is the fact that Robert went back and read my college newspaper articles, which I'm going to talk a little bit about the internet and its effects, and one of the things is that people can go back and when you were, you know, sophomoric, both literally and otherwise, go back and read my review of the movie Shampoo in particular he was talking about, which I thought, oh my God, that was sort of the best. So, 40 minutes is a long time to talk, particularly if you have two people back to back. So I'm going to try to keep you engaged, and this looks like an audience that is very engaged itself in what's going on. So I look forward to your comments. And I am following up on these two articles. That's one of the things we talked about, that they came out in late 05 and early 06, and two plus years down the road, sort of taking stock of where the news media are, and so much happened so quickly that there's plenty to relate. And I'm sure all of you have been following the sort of news about the news business that's come out. It seems like one bad item after another. Circulation rates of our major newspapers just continue to plunge. Revenues tumble. Stock prices dive. There's layoffs and buyouts and bureaus that are closing. And journalism schools, the students are all wondering if they're going to have jobs after they graduate. And so all this is congealed into the conventional wisdom that the news business is in free fall, that the gathering, presentation, and dissemination of news as we know it seems under graver threat than ever before. Well, after looking at the numbers, reading all this, all the reports on this, talking to my colleagues in the profession, I've come here to report to you today that the conventional wisdom is largely correct. I wish that I could poo-poo it, as is always more fun, but really the news does seem very, very gloomy these days. I don't know how many of you know the Romanesco website, which is sort of the bulletin board for the news business. They basically post items that appear in news organizations about the news business, and so it's a great place to sort of keep up on what's going on. And reading the postings there is like reading dispatches from a war front. I mean, every day it's sort of like another setback has been suffered. One of the recent items there, I haven't followed up on this, but it said that Tom Ricks, who is works for the Washington Post and really one of our top Pentagon correspondents, who wrote the book Fiasco, which I think is an excellent book about the Iraq War, it said that he might be accepting a buyout from the Washington Post. So if he does, he will be yet another of journalist who sort of joined this exodus. I guess maybe you're in that category too, from our leading newspapers.
I didn't join voluntarily.
Oh, okay. I was putting volunteers and others into that group. Of course, the main driving force of all this, the main sort of culprit, if you will, is the internet, which has been taking away advertising from newspapers. Craigslist, people can post their classified ads there for free, and why bother with going to a newspaper and putting it in there? And you know, one of the greatest giveaways in history are the free newspaper websites, where you no longer have to buy the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times. You can get all that information for free. Now, one of the great discussions in the industry has been, and one of the great challenges, is could the internet be made profitable itself? Can somehow the revenues and readership, number of readers lost through the internet, can there be a way of generating new advertising from the internet itself? And certainly websites have been moving to take advantage of this. When I was writing those articles, I had a discussion with the person who runs the LA Times website, and he was very encouraging about the revenue lines going up every year. They kept increasing, and I remember they were talking about maybe in getting to a point where $50 million would come in largely through advertising on the web. And that seemed encouraging. And Columbia Journalism Review about a year ago had an article by Bob Kuttner. Many of you probably know of him, a well-known journalist, American Prospect and elsewhere. And he did an article looking at the Internet and to what degree was it likely to become a sufficient producer of revenue so as to provide a new revenue stream and base for the major newspapers, news organizations. And he was very sanguine, actually. He said that, you know, there are basically these two lines that are going. One is the sort of revenue line going down from traditional sources, advertising, circulation, and then the web line revenue line going like this. And at some point, the hope was that the two would meet, and then the revenues from the websites would more than compensate for the downward turn. And I read his article, and I just actually came to the conclusion that it was wishful thinking for the most part. And we all have engaged in it. We'd love to see this happen. But I, talking to people in the field, just to have nobody at this point really has seen the point where those lines are going to cross. And maybe we'll be wrong. Maybe Kuttner will be right, and I actually hope so. I want to talk about the Internet more and its effects because it's such a critical thing. But first, I just want to talk about what I see as some of the effects on the news gathering process itself from what's been happening, this crisis in the industry, and the effects that I see on the actual news gathering and dissemination process. So one effect that you see is that I think that there is this increasing bifurcation between the papers in the top tier in our country, and those that are just under in the sort of high-quality second tier. So basically, I think it's generally agreed that there are four papers in the top tier in this country: the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the Los Angeles Times. Very huge staffs, top journalists working there, basically cover the world in much greater depth and comprehension than anywhere else. And below there, you traditionally have had this other very good tier with newspapers like the Boston Globe and Newsday and the Baltimore Sun and the Miami Herald and the Philadelphia Inquirer. And while I think that the top tier has certainly been affected a lot, I think that this second tier, you see the most dramatic fallout from what's been going on. About a year ago, I was in New England for about a month, and I looked at the Boston Globe on a regular basis, and I have to say that I was just shocked at what has become of that paper. They have disbanded all of their foreign bureaus. They no longer have their own foreign, it was never huge, their bureaus. They had maybe a half dozen, but they were disbanded. Their national desk, their national news desk was disbanded. Now they still have a fairly sizable staff, and they still have a presence in Washington. But the paper, I was amazed at how local the news was on the front page, and there were articles about the repossession rates of cars by sheriffs. This was a lead story one day. I remember when there was a lot of international news going on. Now I'm not to say that that's not an important story. I'm not saying that. But I was shocked to what degree the Globe was repositioning itself as sort of a local supplement to, say, getting the New York Times. Now, actually, the Times owns a share of the Boston Globe, and there's all these views that, like, they were intentionally doing this somehow so that people would have to buy both the Times and the Globe. But I've never seen any evidence it's the case. And matter of fact, it's not only the Globe that's being affected that way. My hometown paper, the Baltimore Sun, used to be a very formidable paper with a very good Washington presence. And they still do have a Washington bureau, and they still do break stories, but many, many fewer than there used to be. You see more and more of these papers rely on either the wire services or the national news services like the New York Times Syndicate for their own coverage of the country and the world, whereas before the Baltimore Sun always had a person in Moscow and they would have a person in Jerusalem and so on, and that's being cut back tremendously. So overall, the coverage is shrinking. In some ways, you see the problem most dramatically in Washington, where the number of people covering government has shrunk tremendously. Just in the last, we're talking the last 5 years. And here it's not only those second-year papers, but even our top papers as well. I actually had a conversation when I was doing those articles with Doyle McManus, the Washington bureau chief of the LA Times. And even though the LA Times still, at that point, and continues to have a large presence in Washington, I mean, I think their bureau has 50 people or so. He was saying that if you take the large number aside that are assigned now to covering foreign policy and national security issues, and others who are covering sort of set B, that he had only 4 reporters left to cover the whole range of domestic policy and agency issues, like covering the Food and Drug Administration. There is an example of something which is absolutely a critical organization, a government agency in terms of supervising pharmaceuticals and medical supplies. What's that? That they're not super. Yeah, I mean, they've been cut back under Bush tremendously. And as a result, when something horrible happens, like the products from China and so on, then it makes news. But this ongoing oversight by the media of this, and Congress itself has largely pulled back from its oversight. Now, it's gotten somewhat better after the 06 election because the Democrats took control of Congress and they're doing much more aggressive oversight. But even so, we've had cutbacks in these agencies, cutback in congressional oversight, and if you add the media, the news media cutbacks as well, we just have so much less information and investigation about how these different agencies are operating. Security and Exchange Commission. Actually, one of the telling points that Doyle McManus made to me was he said, you know, agriculture is a huge industry in America. And for instance, Chicago Tribune, because of where it's located, they cover that on a regular basis. But the LA Times now no longer has anybody who can cover agribusiness on a regular basis. So when you think that one of our leading newspapers cannot afford one person to cover that, I mean, I understand it from an economic standpoint. One could say Sam Zell, who now owns the paper, you know, who reads that stuff anyway? But from a citizen standpoint and from an informed public, you know, look at all the issues going on in the agricultural field and food production and so on. It's just tremendously and sadly underreported. Foreign coverage. One of the items posted on the Romanesco website was CBS thinking of outsourcing its news gathering to CNN. They were basically going to get out of their foreign news gathering and let CNN do it for them. Now, as horrible as that sounds, basically, CBS, in a way, has gotten out of our news gathering business a long time ago. In those articles that Robert mentioned, I wrote about a book by Tom Fenton, who was a longtime correspondent for CBS. And the book basically laid out how much CBS had changed from the early 70s when he had started till now. And when he started, he said, the Rome Bureau at CBS had 3 people in it. Now I think they have 4 people to cover all of Europe. And they're basically in London. And not only Europe, but basically what happens now is the news is packaged. Foreign news, you have things like Associated Press TV, APTV. They do, as a wire service, gather news footage. And then people in London for CBS do the voiceover for it. And it'll be interesting if you watch actually this is interesting, how many people here still watch a network newscast, you know, 6:30 or 7? Raise your hand. TBS, let's leave them out for the moment. Wow, and you are the demographic that these networks are appealing to, so that's interesting. I basically watch it because I monitor the news. I find it such a frustrating enterprise that if I didn't have to, I really wouldn't. But if you do watch it, well, I'm going to have to ask you all a little while, like where you do get your news from. But well, how many people read the New York Times every day? That's impressive here in L.A.
Online.
Okay, how many read it online? How many buy the newspaper?
Well, that's still nothing.
What's that?
You can read it without buying it in some cases.
Well, that's, yeah, that's right. How many read the LA Times online? How many buy it? Oh, that's pretty good. And how many watch the Lehrer News Hour? How many still call it the McNeil Lehrer News Hour?
Leaving out radio.
Well, I was going to mention, yeah, NPR. How many people listen to NPR? Okay, well, you're my type of crowd. But if you watch the network news, it's now totally hypothetical for you all, but it's interesting. Foreign news reports, they will often identify who is the correspondent, but they will not say from where. Because usually it's either New York or London, even though the story might be in Kenya or Iraq, or although they do have bureaus in Iraq, or, you know, in Beijing or something. So it's a telling little sign of how they no longer actually are on site. Iraq, of course, it's extraordinarily expensive to cover that issue, largely because of the security costs. These news organizations don't like to publicize how much security they have, because it's actually seen as insecure to tell too much about it. But they all employ these sort of former SAS or other type of military types to advise them on where you can go and where you can't. They have armored vehicles. They have chase cars. I mean, it's really a terrible situation, but it's expensive. And many news organizations have abandoned a presence in Baghdad, also because interest in Iraq, of course, has been going down. But it's a major loss to have those type of cutbacks go on. Now, a fourth effect, and the last I'm going to talk about right now from this crisis, is so the need for advertising is such that there is more and more a tendency to go after where the money is. I mean, obviously, that's always the case, but it's become intensified. For instance, there's old department stores that were always a big source of advertising revenue. A lot of them have either closed down or merged, and so those have become less lucrative sources of revenue. And what you find is more chasing of consumers of high-priced goods and high-end fashion concerns and so on. So for all of you who get the New York Times, this is an advantage. If you get online, you're not going to get this. But if you buy it, you get those glossy New York Times Sunday sections, which is, I think, called Tea. And they are filled with, you know, Ferragamo and Vendi and this and Hermes and so on. And now, an editor of the New York Times recently told me those are our gold mine now, that the news section is being subsidized in part by this high-end advertising. So he said, don't look down at it, you know, and we have all these style sections and whatnot. That's actually partly underwriting our news section. But there is an effect in the coverage, which is that you have more articles inevitably catering to that type of crowd. You want those affluent readers. For instance, you find the poverty beat has largely disappeared at many papers because these type of readerships don't really want to read these type of stories that much. You know, after Katrina, there was a whole rediscovery of poverty in America, and all the Time magazine and other places, they even did mea culpas on that. Like, we have been ignoring poverty, but now we see that the face of it has arisen again, and we're determined. And there was a period where more was done, and even on New Orleans, you still see follow-up, less the press. But the poverty beat is just very hard to find now. What you do find are these giant business sections in our papers, which sometimes they do very good business reporting, but it is from a business standpoint. And labor reporting, for instance, has never was very big. Usually, you know, you'd have one or two reporters at most at a paper covering the labor or working class worker type beat. And these are being phased out. And in those articles, I talked to the LA Times labor reporter, Nancy Cleland, who really an excellent reporter, won a Pulitzer for some of her reporting. And she basically left her beat in frustration because it wasn't getting, her articles were not getting much play, and she was not replaced as of the last time I checked. And I assume that, I don't know if the LA Times has a labor reporter now or not. New York Times still has Stephen Greenhouse, who does a very good job. But if you compare how many people reporting on the working class compared to, you know, the business world and every last maneuver and merger and acquisition, I mean, it's a sad disparity going on there. So I want to just, aside from these, like what I see effects from the crisis going on in the news media right now, these immediate effects from the cutbacks and so on, I want to look at some of what I see as underlying structural problems that are affecting the media right now. Because these are sort of, here we have these more recent phenomena, these effects, but there's some underlying problems I see that go beyond that. Let's start with the current political campaign. How many of you saw the debate on ABC last week? It's really been fascinating to read the commentary on the debate. I watched it, and I was so appalled, and I was in the situation, you know, you sometimes get where you see something that so upsets you, and I go, why don't I have a way of, you know, I want to bring this to the world's attention, you know, if I only had an outlet. And luckily, you know, here was a case where the whole world was having, you know, themselves were seeing what was going on. And it's been great that people have reacted in such a way to what really seemed an incredibly shoddy and low-class debate led by the questioning, not so much the responses. And, you know, there was this one interesting moment, the whole Bill Ayers question that came up, the Weatherman question. And, you know, if you watch this debate, I'm sure you all have followed this, right, that about Obama being asked about, you're sitting on a board with this man who threw bombs. And I mean, you know, there are some, you know, it's an issue, but, like, they're holding Obama to account for what this guy did 40 years ago. As it turns out, George Stephanopoulos, do you know how this question, where he got it from? He was on Sean Hannity's program either earlier today or the day before, and Hannity said, why don't you ask Obama about this? And I heard this played, and Stephanopoulos goes, I'm taking notes right now, you know? And so from Sean Hannity's mouth to Barack Obama's ear, this question got asked. So this is a good illustration of something I wrote about in that, those articles, which was at that time, the end of 2005, the sort of constellation of right-wing media had a huge gravitational pull on the mainstream media because they attacked it so much. And I would say the three ringleaders were at that point and still are largely Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, and Sean Hannity. I mean, these guys have set out basically to discredit the mainstream media, and just the constant attacks. I heard Bill Keller once say that on TV, the editor of the New York Times, that they counted it that Bill O'Reilly attacked the New York Times 60 times in 1 year. And even though one will inevitably say, you know, that that doesn't affect us, in the end it does. You know, if you're going to be attacked like that, it has an effect. And there's then the whole constellation aside from that. All these talk radio people, the Laura Ingrahams and so on, and the Mark Levins, a lot of them, their names are not that well known to people who don't listen in. The right-wing blogs had become very big back then. The Drudge Report, Weekly Standard Online, National Review Online, you can go through these whole series of things, and they were very well plugged into one another, and they would, you know, this echo chamber would go on and have a big effect. Now, 2 years later, looking at this, it's sort of striking the change that has occurred. There's been a leveling of the playing field in a way. And it's not, you know, at the time people were looking to the people remember what on the left is being looked to as the big answer to, like Rush Limbaugh, was Air America, that was going to be the thing. But that really never took off. For whatever reason, I don't know, liberal left talk radio has not had as big a thing. Although Amy Goodman has a big audience, but she's a different type of thing. But it's really the blogosphere, I think, the liberal left blogosphere has really come back or risen up in a way that now, to some degree, I think, has balanced a little bit this whole din from the right. So the Huffington Post, of course, and Daily Kos and Tom Dispatch and Informed Comment and Bob Syke, Truthdig, and a whole range of things are out there now that are sort of like, you know, making commentary from the other side. And I think it's had its own effect. I mean, for instance, the New York Times military correspondent Michael Gordon has been one of the people most often in the sights of these websites. And, you know, Clark Hoyt, the public editor of the New York Times, is, I think, like, wrote a column about Gordon's own coverage, and that itself ends up having an effect. Even more important, I mean, the rise of these sites is taking place in a more general political shift going on in the country. Country is moving in a liberal democratic direction in certain ways. And one of the premises that I've come to believe in as a result of reading the press over a long period of time is that the press is extraordinarily sensitive to the political climate. And so when George Bush was riding high, particularly in the lead up to the Iraq War, the press was very timid. The higher the president's poll numbers, the more timid the press, I think. And as George Bush's poll numbers have gone down, the press has become much more aggressive. It's sort of a question as well, where were you when we needed you? But still, it's a positive development. But even though on the political plane and the sort of climate overall has changed, I still see some important imbalances there that don't get as much talked about at the sort of left versus right, you know, or the media, do they list left, do they list right, or so on. Here's another show, I don't know how many of you watch, but Meet the Press. Show of hands? And very, very less. I guess in L.A. on a Sunday.
30 years ago.
L.A., they have better things to do on a Sunday morning. But anyway, it's a very influential show. So yesterday, typical show. They had on, they usually have two segments, the first interview segment, and actually Russert is an excellent interviewer. I will, you know, whatever else I'm going to say, he really is very well prepared on. But who do they have on in the first segment? David Axelrod, who is the chief advisor for Barack Obama's campaign, and Jeff Garin, who has now replaced Mark Penn as the chief consultant for the Clinton campaign. So it's a classic, like, get two partisans on there who both have vested interests, one representing one side, one. Now, often it's a more Democrat-Republican thing. The number of times that they have Joe Biden on the one hand, and a sort of one time it was Richard Lugar, he sort of fell out of there. Now Lindsey Graham will be the person they handle. So they have like these two very establishment types, or two people who are very partisan, you know, with their talking points. You know, and it's totally predictable what you're going to get from these people. And now in the segment after, where they have a round table, they had David Brooks, E.J. Dion, and then Michelle Norris from NPR. So politically, you know, it's like balanced, but these are all, in my view, political insiders. They're all part of the political class in the country and part of the establishment. Now, you know, E.J. Dion does very good work. I like reading him. But I feel that these people are, to some degree, prisoners of Washington and of the whole political game as it's played. And very, you know, it's a partisan type of thing. Russert twice has had these shows where the four people he had on discussing the political campaign were Bob Schrum, longtime Democratic consultant, Mike Murphy, longtime Republican consultant, and then a pair that you might be familiar with, Jim Carville and Mary Maitland, the oldest vaudeville act in politics these days. And you have these four people talking, they all are just like promoting their own particular lines, and they all have ties to the candidates, so they all have these conflicts going on. And he had this quartet on twice in 5 weeks. And it's not only the insider type crowd, it's also what I see as a tremendous amount of opinionizing that goes on. And these people do not get out into the field very much. They're sort of, this is sort of a form of like studio journalism, as I see it, people in studios. And we see this in particular on election nights now. You know, everybody is excited by the campaign, and we watch the primary results. You have all these people in these studios who, like, rarely get out and talk to actual voters, you know, to find out what might be going on there. So they, like, pick apart these polling numbers, and the consultants have said this, and so on and so forth. And I just feel like watching a lot. Now, some of the people are good. I don't want to go too far on this. I mean, like, Eugene Robinson has become a character on these shows, and I often find him very interesting. But I just too often feel, how do you people know what you're saying? How do you know what's going on out there? And they've been wrong so many times. I mean, every night it's, oh, look at the surprise that went on. We didn't realize that, you know, Hillary had this much support in New Hampshire, or that Obama's going to win Iowa like this, and so on and so forth. And, you know, if you look back, 2004, when George Bush won, surprising many, many pundits, it was like, what went on here? And then we had weeks of commentary, people going, and again, it was all looking at the exit polls and numbers. Very few of these people had actually gone out in the field to actually interview people and try to get a sense from the grassroots up of what was going on. And it's not just television. I find that newspapers also, too much of the opinionizing, punditizing going on. I mean, the New York Times, which, you know, is the paper of record of people in this room mostly, and, you know, their columnists are often very entertaining, and I like a number of them. But again, I find that if you take Frank Rich, Maureen Dowd, Gail Collins, Paul Krugman, and David Brooks, how often do these people speak to an actual ordinary American? I just don't find it happening that much. And so here, for instance, you have, this is the Times op-ed page from April 18th, and this is in response to the Bitter comment, the whole debate over, you know, Bitter, which was a manufactured type of thing. So Paul Krugman, Wayne in here, David Brooks, Wayne in here, and it was just fascinating to read. Krugman is, you know, he's quoting, he says, I used to believe in Tom Frank's book about what was wrong with Kansas until my Princeton colleague, Larry Bartels, cited data showing that small-town working-class Americans are actually less likely than affluent metropolitan residents to vote on the basis of religion. And then also Brooks, you know, the fact is voters want a president who basically shares their values and life experiences. I mean, on what ground do you say this? Now, David Brooks is actually an interesting case because he is actually does go out and interview people. As a matter of fact, he wrote a piece I was sort of impressed in which he said, you know, I make it a rule to interview 3 people every day so that I can, like, get outside of my own bubble and see what's going on out there. First of all, 3 people every day, if you're a columnist as busy as he is, that's a lot. I wonder if he really does that. But the thing that always amazes me is, how do all the voters he interviewed, why do they all sound like David Brooks in the end? Everybody he quotes, it always sounds like he's sort of echoing David Brooks. Anyway, I like Paul Krugman. I think he's very good, even though his take on Obama has been sort of fascinating to watch. But again, I think it's a real limitation. Now, with the Pennsylvania primary, there's actually been some improvement. I had been railing to myself about how reporters had not been getting out into the field and actually talking to these, you know, working people to see what is going on. I want to have a sense of what is going on more underlying politically, what's going on in this country. It's not like diner journalism. It's not just going to a diner and talking to 6 people. It's spending time in the field and finding some of these deeper political, social shifts going on in the country. And in fact, with Pennsylvania, because this sort of white working class voting block is seen as key, there's been some very good reporting on that, and I've actually been encouraged to see more of that is going on. But generally, I still find, you know, the whole question of is the liberal media elite is one of these slogans that has been bandied about a lot lately. And the liberal part of it is very, you know, open to a rousing debate. But I find the elite part of it is a very true characteristic. And that can cut both ways. It can be a liberal elite, but can also be the establishment elite. And I've been, for the last few months, been trying to get the Columbia Journalism Review to do a an article, which I've tentatively entitled, using working title, Dinner Parties. And it would be about all the dinner parties that journalists go to with the people they cover. And in Washington, this famous example that New York Magazine wrote about of Philip Taubman in, I think it was 2004, who was the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times. He's an old college friend of Condoleezza Rice, and he had a birthday party for her at his townhouse in Washington. I mean, while he's the New York Times bureau chief. So if you've ever wondered how Condoleezza Rice has managed to get such positive coverage in the face of having led one of the most disastrous foreign policies in recent history, that might be a clue. Starting to run out of time here. Briefly going to talk about Iraq for 1 minute. Been some very good reporting out of Iraq in face of tremendous obstacles and violence that has been going on there. But I see a parallel issue going on there. There has been reporting at a certain level, but getting under the surface, and in this case, not talking to American voters, but talking to ordinary Iraqis, has really been missing in the coverage, I feel. And so, so much of what's going on there is told through the eyes of the American presence, particularly the U.S. military presence. Because of the embedding that goes on, just so much is seen through the eyes of U.S. military. And I became aware of this when I wrote an article about a blog that the McClatchy News Service has, in which they gave their staff, their Iraqi staff, basically our U.S. news organizations, because it's so dangerous, have come to rely increasingly on Iraqis and covering the news, Iraqi reporters who are very courageous, and many of them have died in the course of duty. But they actually gave a blog where they could report what they have been experiencing, what it's like to live in Iraq, how Iraqis see the U.S., how they see the government there. And in fact, the government in Iraq is so unpopular. And I feel this is an element that you don't hear about. It's sort of like, will the Maliki government do what the U.S. wants so that we can get out? But they have no credibility from so many of the opinions that I've heard from these Iraqis. The New York Times actually has started a similar blog to, I believe that they were inspired by the McClatchy blog, and that they now, if you go, this is an advantage of going to the website and not getting the newspaper, that you can click on to the Iraqi blog site and you get some very fresh looks at what's going on in Iraq there. So this shows the tremendous potential that the internet does bring to journalism. And I just want to close with some thoughts about the internet and the effects that it has had on the news gathering business. And I think they're good and bad effects. I mean, the good effect is that if the news media are elite and establishment oriented, the internet has provided a tremendous counter to that. It's allowed people at the grassroots all over the country, ordinary people, to have a voice that would have been impossible before. You know, the idea that there a lot of the blogs are called pajamas media because it's people in their pajamas that even before they go outside are at home blogging. And so you get it on both left and right. You get a Michelle Malkin on the one hand, who's this very conservative woman who has become very influential, anti-immigrant, pro-military, and so on. And a Marcos Melitzis, who does the Daily Kos, which has a staff of two people and 600,000 visitors every day, according to their own page. So the internet, I think, you know, it's letting 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 voices bloom or blare. And, I mean, this has been a great phenomenon. But in terms of, if we go back and look at the context of the cutbacks going on in the news media, what you have is that gap is not being filled by the blogosphere. And that gap, I mean the cutbacks in news gathering and information gathering, which tends to be very expensive and time-consuming. And most blogs or websites do not have the resources to do that. So you take an example of, you know, the New York Times. I don't know how many of you saw Sunday Story. This was an amazing piece about the analysts on TV who are former military people, you know, those people on CNN and Fox and MSNBC, and how many of them are consultants for military contractors, and how many have been wined and dined by the Pentagon. And you open it up, and it goes on for 3 pages inside. I mean, only the most well-financed and organizations with large staffs can do something like that. The Washington Post, you know, the Walter Reed scandal. They just did tremendous work on that, and they just also the series about Dick Cheney and his power, for which they won a Pulitzer Prize. So this type of news gathering is just very hard to do if you don't have the resources. Now, there on the web, there are some places that are doing some of this. The most well-known example is Josh Marshall, who has Talking Points Memo is his website. And he has now been able to hire a staff. He has, I think, 7 people or so who are actually doing investigative reporting and muckraking and all the other things that we like to see. But, you know, the Columbia Journalism Review did an article about him, and they actually said that while some people looked at him as a model for what could happen on the web, that he, in fact, might be the exception that proves the rule, which is that because of the way he got started and because of his own particular talents and so on, that he's been able to put something together that financially will be very hard for other places to do. There is one other new venture, though, which some of you probably have heard about, called ProPublica, which is this wealthy couple in San Francisco named the Sandlers have given $10 million to set up a website to hire journalists. And they hired Paul Steiger, who recently left the Wall Street Journal as their managing editor. And they're going to be doing investigative journalism and hopefully getting it out, disseminating it through established news organizations. But so far, and so all eyes are on ProPublica to see what it might be able to do. Will that provide a new model for web-based news gathering? It relies on the philanthropic impulses of very wealthy people. And, you know, as we know, there's a lot of money out there. How many people are going to be willing to, I don't know, we'll see. You know, it's not impossible that more money will go into these type of things. But if you have to depend on sort of plutocrats to fund this, I don't know that that's a stable model. So wrapping up here, I mean, there are many exciting things actually going on. And I'm going to end up on the note of, like, what to watch for that potentially show ways out of the current dilemma. One positive element is the Associated Press. There's a wire service that realizes that newspapers are cutting back and is expanding tremendously, and they're consciously getting away from the old he said, she said journalism and doing more investigation, doing more analysis, because they realize that there's a market for it. And Reuters also has got a tremendous presence around the world. There are documentaries being made now. This is a major growth industry. Taxi to the Dark Side just won an Academy Award for a hard-hitting documentary about U.S. Abuse of prisoners, Guantanamo and Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. We mentioned NPR. Thanks to Joan Kroc's $100 million gift, they've expanded tremendously and I think now are doing better work than they ever have. Google and Yahoo, such wealthy organizations, right now they are basically news aggregators. They basically take the news that other places produce and provide you a convenient portal where you can go and get it. If Google and Yahoo decide that it's in their interest to start putting some of their vast profits into news gathering, they could create a whole new set of players. And in fact, on Yahoo, there is a journalist named Kevin Seitz who runs something called the Hot Zone, where this one guy, because the technology now is so low budget with digital cameras, he goes around the world filing reports from different conflict zones. But the one thing I have to say, if you go on his site, he says, I'm committed. In his first year, he was committed to covering 20 conflict zones in 1 year. How can one guy go around and do justice to 20 conflict zones? So it shows you there's potential there, but the poor guy is overwhelmed and needs some help. So will that happen? And so the final point is we are now living in a new political era, I think, or it seems to be happening. One of the things that is most depressing, has most depressed people in the news business, is young people have not been reading newspapers. They've not even been following the news. So who is going to sustain the news business in the years to come? People are worried that there aren't going to be future consumers of the news. Could this be changing now that young people are getting so mobilized? Two nights ago, I was at a Passover Seder in New York, and the 12-year-old son of one of the people there told me that he had just made a contribution to Barack Obama. And he used his mother's checkbook. But I thought the fact that this 12-year-old was so mobilized as to sort of get involved, and thinking, aha, that could be a future newspaper reader as well. So we're entering a new era in which a lot of things are happening. 10 years ago, nobody knew what a blog was, and now they seem to be omnipresent. So who knows, the combinations of technology and a new engaged generation maybe will create new approaches to the gathering and distribution of news that we don't even know now. So I thought I'd end on a positive note, given that everything else seemed to be pretty gloomy.
Thanks a lot, Michael.